This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. The Philippines military chief is demanding that China return several rifles and equipment seized by the Chinese Coast Guard during a violent confrontation near a disputed shoal in the South China Sea. Here's AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer with details.
After a scuffle and repeated collisions, the Chinese seized the boats and damaged them with machetes, knives, and hammers. Chinese personnel on board more than eight motorboats repeatedly rammed, then boarded the two Philippine inflatable Navy boats to prevent Filipino Navy personnel from transferring food and other supplies, including firearms, to a Philippine territorial outpost in Second Thomas Shoal, which is also claimed by Beijing. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
UN officials said Wednesday that Israeli forces may have violated the laws of war in Gaza by failing to distinguish between civilians and fighters in its bombing campaign, with the high civilian costs amounting to the extermination of Palestinians in Gaza. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder has more.
The UN Rights Office issued a report examining six Israeli attacks that caused many casualties and destroyed civilian infrastructure. Spokesperson Jeremy Lawrence.
Unlawful targeting, when committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack against a civilian population, may also implicate the commission of crimes against humanity.
The head of the UN Commission of Inquiry, Navi Pillay, said perpetrators of abuses in the conflict must be brought to account.
We conclude that Israeli authorities are responsible for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and violations of international humanitarian and human rights law.
That was Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. This is VOA News. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, on Wednesday urged all nations to do everything possible to stop the conflict in Sudan during a visit to the war-torn country.
Civilians are the ones that have no responsibility, no fault of their own in this conflict, and yet, as so often happens, they are the ones paying the highest price.
Grandi also warned that a terrible famine is looming and severe floods will soon hamper humanitarian aid deliveries even more. That's according to UN Deputy Spokesman Farhan Haq. Friends and family searched for missing pilgrims to the Hajj on Wednesday as the death toll at the annual ritual surged past 900. This year's annual pilgrimage for Muslims was carried out in scorching heat, with temperatures on Monday reaching as high as 51.8 degrees Celsius in Mecca, Islam's holiest city. About 1.8 million people from all over the world took part in the Hajj. Cyril Ramaphosa has been sworn in for a second term as South Africa's president in a ceremony in the administrative capital, Pretoria. VOA's Kate Bartlett has more.
Ramaphosa's African National Congress Party lost its parliamentary majority in the May elections for the first time since the end of apartheid 30 years ago. The ANC then engaged in talks with political opponents to form a coalition government that it is calling a government of national unity. Ramaphosa referenced that in his inaugural speech.
Voters of South Africa did not give any single political party the full mandate to govern our country alone. They have directed us to work together.
The ANC struck a deal with the main opposition party. He is expected to appoint his cabinet in the coming days. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Authorities in Poland on Wednesday fined a hospital for denying an abortion to a woman whose pregnancy may have endangered her life. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
It marks a shift in the country with some of the strictest termination rules in Europe. The country's previous nationalist government introduced a near-total ban on abortion in 2021. They were only allowed in cases of rape, incest, or threat to the woman's health or life, but even then, doctors could still refuse to perform them on moral grounds. The issue has sparked massive protests in recent years. In 2023, women's rights were front and center in the election campaign that ushered in a pro-European coalition government. It recently introduced a regulation to penalize publicly funded medical centers that refuse legal procedures.
That was Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. Follow us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at voanews.com, as well as on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Vladimir Putin visits Vietnam.
For Putin, the trip is to signal that Russia is not isolated in Asia despite the Ukraine war. For Vietnam, Russia remains an important partner.
The UN says Israel is violating human rights in Gaza,
including extermination, intentionally directing attacks against civilians and civilian objects.
And for the first time ever, London's V&A Museum dedicates an exhibition to a model.
Naomi Campbell's remarkable 40-year career is really kind of, I think, proving that she's an exemplar in the field.
Today is Thursday, June 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman, along with Alexa Strope.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is in Vietnam for talks with the country's communist leaders. Associated Press correspondent Anna Ruta Goshal reports on what the two nations hope to come from the meetings.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to Vietnam is taking place at a time when Moscow is facing growing international isolation because of its invasion of Ukraine. This is Putin's first visit to the Southeast Asian nation since 2017. For Putin, the trip is to signal that Russia is not isolated in Asia despite the Ukraine war. For Vietnam, Russia remains an important partner, not just for long historical ties, but also because Russia is the biggest supplier of military equipment. Russian oil exploration technologies help maintain Vietnam's claims over the contested South China Sea. Vietnam is reinforcing its traditional relationship with Russia while it diversifies ties with newer partners, most notably the U.S. But Putin's visit resulted in a sharp rebuke from the American embassy in Hanoi.
AP correspondent Anna Ruta Goshal. Putin will attend wreath-laying ceremonies, including at the Ho Chi Minh Mausoleum, housing the embalmed corpse of Vietnam's founding leader.
So let's dig deeper into this. Joining us now to talk about it is Irina Sukerman, a human rights and national security lawyer based in New York and a fellow at the Arabian Peninsula Institute. So Putin is just coming off his meetings in North Korea, where he was reviving a Cold War relationship. And now he's in Vietnam, a relationship that they've maintained through almost everything. Hanoi is, Russia is still Hanoi's weapons supplier. But this is different in that when he was in North Korea, they were able to bond over their adversary, the United States. In Vietnam, both the United States and China have been getting closer to Vietnam. Both President Biden and President Xi were in Vietnam just last year. What does Putin need to do there, do you think?
So let's start with the fact that while Russia, or rather the Soviet Union and then Russia, remained the main supplier for Vietnam's weapons starting from 1950s and, of course, all throughout the Vietnam War, the relationship wasn't always on the same level. Gorbachev and Yeltsin, they both favored China, relationship with China, and so they kind of moved away from more political engagement with Vietnam. And it was Putin who started to revive the relationship on a diplomatic level. So, first of all, Vietnam is still highly dependent on weapons, even despite more recent rapprochements with the United States. The other issue is, even though the U.S. has been trying to sell weapons to Vietnam, to precisely for this reason, the Vietnamese Hanoi is not in a rush to buy those weapons. Let's remember that Vietnam is still a communist authoritarian regime. It is concerned that engaging in sale of, in buying weapons from the U.S. can lead to an unwelcome scenario where the Congress makes these sales dependent on human rights and democratic, basically, measurements. And they don't want to do that in that situation, particularly because they are having increased tensions with China over territory.
Sure, over the South China Sea, and Russia and China have been getting closer together. How does that play into the dynamic?
Well, there are some issues that Russia and China still have disagreements over, and that includes the fact that Russia is one of the leading investors in oil and gas projects and joint projects with Vietnam, and China considers some of those offshore deposits in the waters, they consider it part of their own territory, the ones that they're disputing with Vietnam. So they're not particularly happy about Russia's role in the Vietnam's energy sector because they expect Russia to side with them over that issue. The problem for Putin, however, is that he is running out of options with countries increasingly being reluctant to work with Russia either on weapons trade or on energy. And so for him, Vietnam is an important client, which he does not want to lose, and if possible, he wants to steer Vietnam away from its burgeoning, its new relationship with the U.S. Now, that said, Vietnam has been diversifying its supply of weapons to Japan, South Korea. It's actually also been working in Czech Republic. It's also been working with India, which has its own supply of old Soviet and Russian weapons to retrofit some of its existing arsenal. But at the end of the day, Russia as a leading supplier of weapons is not going anywhere for the time being. It has seen the failure of Russian weapons, particularly things like tanks and S-400 in Ukraine. So this is why even though the bulk of their defense infrastructure is still Russian-based, they're looking towards other countries. And Putin is also sensing that. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's pursuing Vietnam very aggressively and engaging on political issues, engaging in an open show of support to show that this is not just a trade pact as it was under Gorbachev and Yeltsin, but that he is returning to this Soviet-style relationship where the Vietnamese leaders were actually trained in Moscow, not in China.
Mm. Thank you so very much for the time.
Absolutely. I'm always happy to talk. Please reach out if you ever need anything else.
Irina Zuckerman, a human rights and national security lawyer based in New York.
Putin is coming off a successful visit to North Korea. He and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un upgraded their country's relationship as they met Wednesday in Pyongyang. Both men signed a treaty they say contains a mutual defense clause. The developments are being criticized by the U.S. and its allies, who say the relationship is a threat to global peace. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul, South Korea.
Two isolated leaders looking for friends. They met one-on-one for 2 hours. Afterwards, the two men signed a treaty, pledging to come to each other's defense if attacked. But Putin said the comprehensive partnership agreement signed today includes, among other things, mutual assistance in the event of aggression against one of the parties to the agreement. Kim said our two countries' relations have been elevated to a new high level of alliance. The signing of the Mutual Defense Treaty surprised many observers who view the Putin-Kim relationship as a marriage of convenience. Ramon Pacheco Pardo is a professor at King's College London.
Kim Jong-un has been able to extract more concessions than before he would be able to.
But while Putin and Kim may be trying to reanimate Soviet-era relations, not all analysts are convinced that will be easy, noting the relationship has long seen ups and downs. For now, both men are portraying friendly relations. Before leaving Pyongyang, Putin gave Kim a luxury Russian limousine, even taking him for a drive around palace grounds, an attempt to present a unified stance as each man confronts the West. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
More condemnation for Israel. The UN Commission of Inquiry says Israel is guilty of war crimes and human rights violations,
including extermination, intentionally directing attacks against civilians and civilian objects, murder or willful killing, using starvation as a method of war, forcible transfer, gender persecution targeting Palestinian men and boys, sexual and gender-based violence amounting to torture, and cruel or inhuman treatment.
That's Navi Pillay, the head of the UN Commission of Inquiry. She repeated findings from a report published last week that both Hamas and Israel have committed war crimes, but said that Israel alone was responsible for the most serious abuses under international law, known as crimes against humanity.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Cyril Ramaphosa has been sworn in for a second term as South Africa's president. Ramaphosa is now set to appoint a cabinet in a new coalition government. A U.S. soldier was sentenced on Wednesday to almost 4 years in a Russian penal colony after a Russian court found him guilty of stealing money from his girlfriend and threatening to kill her. He was detained on May 2nd in Vladivostok after an argument with the girlfriend, whom he had met while in South Korea. A new blood test developed by researchers at University College London could help predict Parkinson's up to 7 years before symptoms appear. The test uses artificial intelligence and was able to provide a 100% accurate diagnosis by identifying 8 proteins whose concentrations are altered in patients with Parkinson's.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 presidential election, 2 years ago this month, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision that impacted the nation's political landscape, reversing its 1973 ruling that legalized abortion. Now, abortion looms as a major issue in this year's elections. VOA's senior Washington correspondent, Carolyn Versudi, takes a look at how the issue is changing the presidential campaign.
June 24th, 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court reverses the ruling that made abortion legal and leaves the issue up to the states. Since then, 21 states have passed laws to limit abortions. At a recent Donald Trump rally,
I'm pro-life, but I think people should have a right if they want it to be early and to be done safely and with exceptions for the birth, of a baby or a mother. But it should be up to the states.
A new Gallup poll shows the Dobbs decision galvanized single-issue voters 2 years ago and continues to do so.
We see a record high now, 32% of the electorate saying they'll only vote for a candidate who shares their views on the issue. But again, that hasn't really changed among Republicans and independents. That stayed absolutely steady at about 20, 22%. It's Democrats who have really surged.
Free cone.
One of those voters is Jaden D'Onofrio.
We've seen that the right to choice and recreational marijuana are critical to the beliefs and importance of youth voters and what's top of mind for them, especially with the right to choice.
In May, D'Onofrio's state of Florida enacted one of the most restrictive state laws, making abortion illegal after 6 weeks of pregnancy. President Joe Biden called the current patchwork of laws chaos.
It shouldn't matter where in America you live. This isn't about states' rights, it's about women's rights. The person most responsible for taking away this freedom in America is Donald Trump.
President Biden has his own complicated views of abortion relating to his Catholic faith.
You've been taking the pressure on my family.
Last week, he met with the Pope at the Vatican. The church teaches abortion as immoral, but Catholics are divided on the issue.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint.
Former President Donald Trump takes credit for the Supreme Court decision that outlawed abortion on a national level.
You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections to restore our culture and, in fact, to save our country, which is currently, and very sadly, a nation in decline.
Aside from Gallup says it will be interesting to see whether the Supreme Court decision will change votes in November or simply motivate people to go out and vote. Carolyn Frasutti, VOA News.
Thursday is World Refugee Day. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi is marking it in Sudan and South Sudan, where he has been traveling this week, highlighting the situation of millions of people displaced by war. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Brashear spoke to him from New York and has this report.
Sudan's war has triggered one of the largest displacement crises on the planet, according to the United Nations. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, met some of the displaced this week in Kosti, in the southern part of Sudan.
They're fleeing a horrible violence, very severe violations of human rights, but increasingly they're also fleeing deprivation.
In South Sudan, the UN Refugee Agency is working to assist them. Elsewhere in Africa, the effects of the climate crisis are driving displacement, forcing people to move, especially when coupled with conflicts.
And there, what happens is that climate becomes a cause of conflict. It deprives very poor communities living together of basic resources, water, for example. The communities start fighting, and this generates displacement.
Globally, the numbers of displaced people, refugees, and asylum seekers have been increasing over the last 12 years to a staggering 120 million. Ukraine, Syria, and Afghanistan account for just over half of all forcibly displaced persons. Grandi warns that it will be difficult for an increasingly divided world to meet growing global challenges. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman, along with Alexis Strope. There are dangerous heat waves around the world as we're on track for the warmest year on record. Again. In the United States, from the Midwest to the tip of Maine, millions of people are under heat warnings.
Just try to do whatever you can to stay out the heat wave. We have free water centers everywhere in the city of Columbus.
In China, farmers living near a water reservoir in the Shandong province were struggling on Wednesday with scorching heat that has baked the provincial capital, Jinan, for over a month. More from Reuters correspondent Veta Chan.
Selling his produce along a street in Jinan in eastern China, 56-year-old farmer Li Weidong says the city is as hot as a stove. On Wednesday, authorities in the province declared an orange heat alert. A nearby reservoir, though not completely dried up, is showing signs of distress. This 70-year-old farmer in Jinan says she planted apples, peaches, and other crops during this summer's planting season. She estimates 90% of those crops are now damaged. Even with the drought in the 1960s, it wasn't as dry as it is this year, she says. Back then, it still rained once or twice in the spring, but this year, it hasn't rained even once. In some parts of the wheat-growing provinces of Hebei, Henan, and Shandong, temperatures could reach upwards of 111 degrees Fahrenheit, potentially breaking historical records for the month of June, Chinese state media CCTV said.
That was Reuters correspondent Veta Chan.
Between 600 and 1,000 people have died during this year's Hajj in Saudi Arabia, according to the news services Reuters and AFP, as the faithful faced intense high temperatures at Islamic holy sites in the desert kingdom. The pilgrimage is required of every able Muslim once in their life.
With the tropical Atlantic Ocean and Gulf of Mexico warmer than ever before at this time of year, Tropical Storm Alberto has formed in the southwestern Gulf. It's the first named storm of what is forecast to be a busy hurricane season. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said that Alberto was east of Tampico, Mexico, with maximum sustained winds of 64 kilometers per hour. The Hurricane Center predicts the hurricane season from June 1st to November 30th is likely to be well above average, with between 17 and 25 named storms.
And finally, supermodel Naomi Campbell brings her stylish looks and runway walk to London's Victoria. Victoria and Albert Museum this week in a new exhibition that the museum says is the first of its kind dedicated to a model. The exhibition, which opens to the public on Saturday, features glamorous frocks, towering heels, and a display of Campbell's fashion photos and magazine covers, curated by former British Vogue editor Edward Enenful.
Well, I think it's an interesting question about why to do an exhibition about Naomi Campbell and why now. And I think in part it's to do with the fact that there's been so many exhibitions about fashion designers and fashion photographers, but the model is often left out of the story. And Naomi Campbell's remarkable 40-year career is really kind of, I think, proving that she's an exemplar in the field, because not only is she working with the best designers and photographers, magazines in the industry, but also she uses her platform to spotlight the careers of emerging creatives as well.
Campbell, who's 54, began her career as a teenager and has modeled for fashion heavyweights like Versace, Chanel, Prada, and Dolce & Gabbana, among many others. She's also championed African designers. She was the first black model to appear on the covers of French Vogue and Time magazine, and was also the first black model on the cover of American Vogue's key September issue.
I think Naomi's impact has been and continues to be not just that she's kind of got a peerless walk on the runway or that she's incredible in front of the camera lens, but also that she uses her platform to spotlight the work of others. She's an activist. I might also add that she credits this activism to her relationship with the late Nelson Mandela, who was the one who I think kind of inspired Naomi to be aware that her platform could be used for good.
The exhibition, which runs until April 6, 2025, includes written and audio commentary from Campbell herself, reminiscing over key moments of her career, as well as a makeshift catwalk for those wanting to imitate her runway walk.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Grope, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 7th, Houthi insurgents raided the homes and offices of humanitarian workers of a number of UN agencies, diplomatic missions, and international and non-governmental organizations. They abducted some 50 people, all of them Yemeni nationals, claiming that the victims were part of an Israeli-U.S. spy network. This latest group of detainees joins a number of other hostages currently held by the Houthis. Although these Yemeni belligerents released 113 hostages in May, most of them for health reasons, they still detain a number of people they have abducted over the past several months or even years. "We condemn these detentions," said U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the UN, Robert Wood, "and we call on the Houthis to release these detainees immediately."
The United States is deeply disturbed by reports that Houthi rebels detained at least 50 Yemeni employees of UN agencies, member state diplomatic missions, private companies, international organizations, and non-governmental organizations. These detentions include 13 UN employees.
"We also strongly condemn Houthi efforts to spread disinformation regarding the role of detained U.S. current and former local staff through televised, forced, and phony so-called confessions," said Ambassador Wood.
"The simple fact is that the Houthis have held these individuals without justification for more than 2.5 years. 2.5 years. Their detention, alongside that of the UN staff, is an affront to international norms. They should all be released immediately."
Yemen is currently in the midst of one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. The detention of humanitarian workers will likely have serious, far-reaching ramifications on the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Yemeni people, many of whom are in urgent need of assistance.
"The humanitarian situation in Yemen remains difficult, and Yemenis need the support of the international community now more than ever. the detention of UN NGO staff directly and negatively affects the ability for organizations to provide humanitarian aid.
Yet again, the Houthis are seeking to use this information to distract from their failures to meet the needs of the Yemeni people, said Ambassador Wood. These actions further call into question the Houthis' commitment to doing what is in the best interests of the Yemeni people. Instead, it shows their focus on their own ideological goals.
That was an editorial reflecting